If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Officials are claiming that the United States will run out of avocados within 3 weeks if President Trump closes the U.S.-Mexico border, which is bad. But I think it's way more disconcerting that everything has to be explained to the public in avocados. There'll be a trade war. Families will be torn apart. Our national reputation will be damaged. Uh-huh. No guacamole. What? Impeach!
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to Timothy Simons from HBO's Veep. Timothy also takes a few more questions backstage at Studio 8G just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
After special counsel Robert Mueller delivered his report, President Trump decided to pick fights over health care in the Special Olympics. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. It's been a little over a week since Trump's Attorney General William Barr released his letter on Mueller's report, stating that the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. And obviously, that was good news for Trump. I'd say he's had a pep in his step ever since, but he doesn't really take steps. If he had a Fitbit, the only thing his Fitbit would ever display is, you up? Now, when Barr released this memo, everyone just assumed it was a summary of Mueller's full report, a word Trump's aides and the media have used over and over again.
The Attorney General's summary of the Mueller report is out.
We received a 4-page summary of the Mueller report.
This was a summary of the Robert Mueller report.
Preview.
We have the Barr summary.
The 4-page summary by Attorney General Barr.
There you go. This was a summary of Mueller's report. Barr told us everything we need to know, and we can all move on. Got it.
The Attorney General tonight sent this letter announcing that everybody misinterpreted what he said last weekend in that letter. What he did last week is being talked about in a way that he didn't expect. That's not at all what he meant, and we should all know better. Quote, I am aware of some media reports and other public statements mischaracterizing my March 24th supplemental notification as a summary of the special counsel's investigation and report. My March 24th letter was not and did not purport to be an exhaustive recounting of the special counsel's investigation or report.
Wait, so it wasn't supposed to be a summary? That's kind of an important detail to leave out. That's like reading the line, the prince and princess lived happily ever after in a fairy tale, and then you turn the page and there's a note saying that was not and should not be mischaracterized at the ending. They got divorced the next day. Now, there is no... To be clear, there's no reason to expect that Barr's memo is distorting Mueller's report. But even if his initial memo was accurate and made in good faith, it's still difficult for anyone to summarize something as long as Mueller's report. For one thing, the report is apparently more than 300 pages long, went well beyond the kind of bare-bones summary required by the Justice Department, and detailed his conclusions at length. And you can't boil a 300-page document down to 4 pages. It's like when you try to cram for a test by reading the Cliff Notes for The Great Gatsby, and you end up writing, "Wealthy man enjoys consequence-free summer in the Hamptons." So we have no idea. No idea what's in the report. Barr says it'll be released sometime this month, And yet some Republicans are already threatening to block the release of a report they say exonerates the president. Last week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell objected to a resolution calling for the report to be made public, and Senator Rand Paul said he would oppose releasing the report until there's an investigation of the Obama administration.
We need to have information on Obama, White House officials, Comey, Brennan, Clapper. That should be part of it. So if Democrats want the complete Mueller report, I'm going to object until we get a complete report of all the Obama-era officials that got this thing started.
You want an investigation of the Obama administration. You investigated him for 8 years and came up with nothing. The worst scandal you dug up was the fact that he wore a tan suit once. Where did you get the suit? How much did you pay for the suit? So Mueller's report did not establish that the Trump campaign conspired with Russia. But still, even if you put aside the question of Russian collusion, Mueller's investigation has still exposed a whole world of normalized corruption by some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in the country that was just accepted in Washington until now. Just look at Paul Manafort. The guy spent years as an unregistered foreign agent lobbying for some of the worst people in the world. And in the process, he sold tens of millions of dollars from the American people, money he used to buy everything from antique rugs to expensive cars to, and this is real, a $15,000 jacket made from an ostrich. Which is why Manafort's heart dropped when he walked into the courtroom and saw the judge. It shouldn't. It shouldn't take a special counsel for us to find out that some of the most powerful people in the country are hoarding their wealth by committing serial fraud and illegally stashing their money in offshore tax havens. Even if nothing else came out of the Russia investigation, people are learning how wealth and power operate in America. I mean, this guy right here was the president's campaign chairman. The only way it could be worse is if Trump made Lori Loughlin his Secretary of Education. And I, of course, I'm just kidding. Betsy DeVos is still worse. I mean, at least Lori Loughlin's trying to make it easier for people to get into college. In fact, even as Trump and his inner circle have spent their time and power enriching themselves, they've also been trying to take health care away from millions of people. Last week, the Trump administration said the entire Affordable Care Act should be repealed. And yet, as if that wasn't enough, the Trump administration also decided to pick a totally unnecessary fight with basically everybody by proposing to cut funding for the Special Olympics.
Education Secretary Betsy DeVos came under fire on Capitol Hill Tuesday while defending proposed funding cuts for the Special Olympics. The Trump administration wants to cut all $18 million in federal money for the program.
How awful do you have to be to try to cut funding for the Special Olympics? You might as well use the money you save to bulldoze an orphanage.
We all know those orphanages are eyesores. We're knocking them down.
And the administration's response to the news was also proof that the president has no idea what his own government is doing. First, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos said it wasn't her idea to make the cut and blasted Democrats for making a political issue out of it during a budget hearing.
As I said then, and I'll say again, this we had to make tough choices and decisions around the budget priorities. I love Special Olympics myself. I have given a portion of my salary to Special Olympics. I hope all of this debate encourages lots of private contributions to Special Olympics. So let's not use disabled children in a twisted way for your political narrative. That is just disgusting and it's shameful.
You guys are the ones who proposed the cut. If you set your neighbor's house on fire and they call 911, you can't turn around and say, "Aren't you the town gossip?" Also, can we go back to this?
I have given a portion of my salary to Special Olympics.
You're a billionaire. The Special Olympics cut was $18 million. Betsy DeVos has, according to Newsweek, 10 boats, 2 helicopters, and a yacht scheduler. She has so many yachts, she has a yacht scheduler. What's a yacht scheduler? Is it someone who... Is a yacht scheduler someone who, when you say bring the yacht around, says, "I wouldn't do that, it might crash into the other yacht"? Then after the hearing, reporters tried to get answers from DeVos as she waited for an elevator, and she responded by pretending not to hear them.
Madam Secretary, do you have any response to the Democrats' criticism of your budget proposal? Madam Secretary, you said today that you were not the person that proposed this funding change. Can you explain who in your administration did? Madam Secretary, have you spoken to the president about this at all? Mm-hmm. If there's some misunderstanding, Madam Secretary, this is your opportunity to explain it to us.
I mean, look at her. That's the face of someone thinking to herself, where's my elevator scheduler? Also, I love how the camera zooms in on her face. CNN apparently got the same director who did The Office. Then, after his education secretary went to Capitol Hill to defend a budget cut that basically everyone hated, Trump just waltzed up to reporters on the White House lawn and told them, never mind, we're funding the Special Olympics after all.
The Special Olympics will be funded. I just told my people, I want to fund the Special Olympics. And I've just authorized a funding of the Special Olympics. I've been to the Special Olympics. I think it's incredible. And I just authorized a funding. I heard about it this morning.
What do you mean you heard about it this morning? You're the president. It's your budget. Who is running this place? I don't want to be this guy, but can you go get your manager? And then, on Friday, Trump just kept lying about the Special Olympics fiasco. During a Q&A with reporters at his resort in Palm Beach, Trump was asked about his decision to overrule sanctions on North Korea that his own administration wanted to implement, and he compared the situation to the Special Olympics by once again lying about it.
I just decided that I would not let it happen. In a certain way, it's like the Special Olympics. For many years, it hasn't been approved, and then at some point, it gets negotiated out in Congress. Well, I went out and I said, we're going to have funding for the Special Olympics.
You didn't save it. You're the one who proposed the cut. Where is your manager? Trump lies like this. He lies like this about everything. In fact, this isn't even the only budget item Trump has lied about this week. Just take something as innocuous as the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which was first implemented by Obama in 2010. Trump requested no funding at all for this initiative in his 2018 budget request, effectively eliminating the program. His latest budget proposes a 90% cut to the program. And yet, at a rally in Michigan last week, Trump told his supporters he was totally committed to funding the program while also making clear he knows absolutely nothing about the Great Lakes.
I support the Great Lakes. Always have. They're beautiful. They're big, very deep. Record deepness, right?
I'm sorry, but I have a hard time believing you have always supported the Great Lakes. You grew up in Queens and worked in Manhattan real estate. As a little boy, I loved two things, giant gold buildings and the lakes in the Midwest. I know them all, Huron, Michelin, Eric, Titicaca, and Inferior. When it comes to lakes, you're out of your depth, or should I say you're out of your...
deepness.
Trump did the same thing while rambling about wind energy at the same rally. He bragged about energy production under his administration, and for some reason, he decided to go on an extended rant about how much he knows about wind.
If Hillary got in, you wouldn't have that stat, I can tell you right now. You'd be doing windmills.
There's one thing we've learned about Trump's presidency so far, is that he loves doing random sound effects.
Bing. Ching. Bing.
That's the whole presidency right there. He lies about funding for the Special Olympics and tries to take away his voters' health care, but they love his sound effects. We're living through the Police Academy presidency. Mueller's report may not have established Russian collusion, but it exposed a whole world of corruption most people didn't know about. Donald Trump isn't working for another country. He's working for himself. He's enriching himself while trying to take health care away from millions. In other words, we're in deep.
Record deepness.
This has been A Closer Look. Our guest stars as Jonah Ryan in the critically acclaimed series Veep. The seventh and final season airs Sundays on HBO. Please welcome to the show Timothy Simons, everyone.
How's it going?
How are you? I'm so happy you're here.
I'm so happy to be here.
Congratulations on the show. I'm certainly not the first person to ask about this, but one of the strangest things that's happened over the course of the 7 years of the show is politics has become maybe stranger than the awful, awful people on Veep.
Yeah, a little bit. Somewhere along the line, we became aspirational.
Yeah.
I don't exactly know how that happened.
Yeah.
No, and I know that like there are a lot of people going through a lot of like really terrible things because of this administration. I'm certainly like, you know, I'm not trying to say like, oh, the premium cable satirists, boy, they are having it rough. But they're having the worst go of this. It is amazing though that when we started the show, what counted as a gaffe doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And now my character is now running for president, and things that you would have thought would have torpedoed, you would have never even bought that he could get there.
Right.
He could get to run for president. And now you have to actually entertain the fact that he could win.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, he's charmless and he's graceless and he's narcissistic and he doesn't care about anybody but himself. And I don't know if you're seeing like Venn diagram overlap.
Yeah. Did you?
But
well, obviously, I think a lot of who you're describing wasn't in politics when this started, but did you base it on any existing politicians when you first jumped into the role?
When I first jumped into the role, it was sort of like a smash together of a bunch of different, I almost said Hollywood because it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same thing. Of just DC lackeys that all they care about is proximity to power. But when we got toward his congressional campaign, the person, speaking of charmless and graceless and just universally disliked, I based a lot of it on Ted Cruz.
Ah, yeah.
Was it Lindsey Graham who had like a great bit about Ted Cruz? I think I'm paraphrasing, but if you were to shoot him on the floor of the Senate, you could not find a witness.
Yeah.
And I feel like Jonah operates in that space, but begrudgingly, you have to admit that Ted Cruz has fallen ass backwards into some sort of power, and until he's out, everybody just has to deal with him. And that very much is Jonah's vibe.
Yes.
That's his thing.
You are one of the most colorfully insulted characters in the history of television.
Yeah.
And I have heard that people will, if they see you, they will then, almost as a way of saying, hey, I'm a fan, they will yell one of those insults at you.
It does happen. It does happen. I beg you to not do it. And, like, there are so many that are profane, and I'm with my children at the grocery store. That's not the time. It has gotten to a point where there have been so many, I almost feel like we have reached like a critical mass where if somebody were to, I've been insulted so many different ways and so many different times that you wouldn't even be able to pick one out of your head. There are so many, which is great for me. But so people now are more so coming up to me to commiserate just about some guy they work with who sucks. And they just think, they're like, oh, you play a guy who sucks.
Yeah.
There's this guy that I work with that sucks. And it's really lovely. You have like a really wonderful human connection with a fan of the show.
That's very nice.
Somebody you work with who just is awful.
You mentioned you have kids. You have twins.
I do.
We're talking about, say, 7 years old. And so that, working backwards from seventh season, you probably had them right when this started, right?
Yeah. They were born right at the end of the first season.
And was that stressful to then be in the middle of this show that obviously, you know, has a very intense shooting schedule and you had two small kids? Like, do you feel like you've managed pretty well?
I think I did okay. I was talking to my therapist about this recently, about how there's no great parenting. There's only good enough. And I know I'm hitting good enough.
Yeah.
But we shot in Baltimore, and so I would have to do a lot of back and forth. And when the kids were young, I mean, like, it's tough. It's tough on me. It's tough on them. It's really tough on my wife, who she's a public school teacher, and they should be paid way more than they are.
Yes.
And so I would go back, and when I'm at home, I try to be very present for them. And as they've grown up, I try to, when I put them to bed, I try to be very present for them. And And they, it's gotten more complicated as they've gotten older. Like, when they were really little, like, the scariest thing that they could come up with was that there was a bear in the room. And sure. If you ask them to describe it, it's a cartoon bear.
Yeah.
It's the nicest bear you've ever met. But recently, I was putting my daughter, her name's Hopper, I was putting her to bed, and she said, "Papa, I think that all adults are monsters, and they're just pretending to be people, which means that you are a monster, and you're pretending to be a person." And I said, "Babe, I understand that you feel that way. I can assure you I am not a monster pretending to be a person. And my job is to keep you safe and to protect you. And until you can keep yourself safe and until you can protect yourself, that is my job. That's what I'm here for. But I'm a comedian." And in the back of my head, and I didn't say it, I was like, if I was a monster pretending to be a person, that is exactly what I would say to get away with it. And it took everything I had to not look her in the eye and tell her that. But I knew that we would just be up all night and I would be so sorry. I'd be so sorry that I did it.
Are they, I don't know, I have no frame of reference about seven-year-olds. Do they appreciate that your show's been a success? Do they know that it's what you do and that people love it?
They don't care at all. Yeah, but they don't care at all. Last year, we won an award. We won a SAG award, a SAG Ensemble Award for the show. And certainly, like, awards aren't, like, it's been really fun that we've been able to go to things like that. It's not the reason we do it. Like, the ensemble is incredibly close, and I love working with them. So that, to win that, that was cool. It was like I got to walk around that night with, like, a physical manifestation of something that is very important to me, like the work that we do as a group. And so the next morning, the kids were at the table. They were eating breakfast. They were getting ready to go to school. And I don't know if you've ever seen a SAG award before, but it has a very defined butt. And I put it on the table, and I was like, "Guys, your dad, your papa won this last night with all, like, you know, his friends that he works with. And I just wanted to show you this. He was really proud of this." And they spent the rest of the breakfast turning the butt toward the other kid and laughing. And then the other kid would turn the butt back toward the other one, and then that kid would laugh. And no, they don't care at all. But if I keep providing butt statues,
yeah,
I think they're going to love it.
Yeah, you know, certainly they would appreciate that. You you mentioned Jonah is somebody and who's desperate to be in proximity to power. Mm-hmm. And your grandfather had a real Jonah story in terms of proximity. He was in World War II.
He was.
This is a true story.
Yes.
Please share.
My grandfather fought in the Pacific Theater in World War II, and he was providing artillery support in Iwo Jima. My grandfather is a very laid-back guy. And at one point, he turned his head to light a cigarette, and when he turned back, they had raised the flag at Iwo Jima, and he missed it. So this giant piece of American history, this battle that had been won.
Yeah. Where do you think your grandfather is then?
Just kind of somewhere over here, not looking at this. There's nothing that nobody would ever confuse a Simons for somebody that would be in here. I tell you, a Simons would come in and be like, "Oh, do you guys need? Oh, you got it. But I don't think those guys get statues built.
Yeah, they don't get statues. Yeah. Hey, congrats again. It's been such a great show, and you've just been such a fantastic part of it. I really appreciate you being here.
Cool.
Timothy Simons, everybody. Veep airs Sundays on HBO.
This is Henry from Late Night. Here with Timothy Simons from Veep.
Hi.
Jonah Ryan.
How's it going?
It's such a pleasure to meet you. I'm such a big fan of the show.
Thanks.
I've been telling you repeatedly today how much I love the show.
And I was in that moment questioning, do I pretend that this is the first time you told me? And do I do the thing where I'm like, that's so nice of you.
Well,
like, I kind of went right down the middle with, like, oh, thanks. Like,
yeah, no, you,
like,
know.
A little bit of a lilt.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's so nice. You know, anyway.
Listeners probably bought it for a second.
For like 1 second.
And now I'm just completely exposed.
I completely undercut it.
This was really interesting to me when I was reading about you, is that Veep was kind of your first show.
It was.
And it's unbelievable that you landed such an amazing role on such an amazing show. And talk about getting cast on the show and then not really knowing what was next for you after you got the part.
When I first auditioned for it, there was a part of me that was like, the success of auditioning for this was certainly not to get cast in it, which seemed 1,000 miles away
yeah.
from. That was the first time I'd ever been called in for like a series regular part. Mm-hmm. I'd never even played a waiter on television before. Yeah. I had acted before. I had spent 12 years pursuing it. I had gone mm-hmm. to school for it, but I had never done it at that level before. And so the success for me was getting called back into her office. It was Allison Jones, who is mm-hmm. sort of famous for casting most of the shows that are beloved in.
Oh yeah, her name is on every single show in the credits. Every show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like she did the original casting for Arrested, and she mm-hmm. did the original casting for The Office. Like she's sort of a legend. And so just getting back into her office was the goal, and it just kept like they just kept going well, despite how nervous uh-huh. I was, despite how much I thought I would never get it. They just kept going well, and then I got cast on it. I got a call 45 minutes after the test. That
really,
been cast.
That fast?
Yeah, I had gotten lost on the way home, and then I was outside of my apartment. I got a call from my friend Peter, who worked in the office, saying that I had gotten it. And the first thing I did was go, and I was like, oh, that's so great. I'm gonna get a sandwich. And I went and got it. There. I was so
that's
overwhelming.
How you celebrated.
I kind of shut yeah. down.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Like I sort of clinically detached and was like, oh, what do I need? I need a sandwich. And so I went and got a sandwich, and I went to my wife's school, and I hung out for a while. And then I went and filmed the pilot. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to my old job, which was running commercial casting. Like I ran camera for commercial casting companies.
That must have been a fascinating job.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And it taught me a lot about like sort of like what things look like on camera.
Yeah,
what
yeah,
reads,
yeah.
Like what reads too big. I also got cast in a bunch of them just kind of
proximity.
By proximity. Like sometimes yeah. I would like be walking to lunch and somebody would be like, oh, hey, do you want to jump in on this audition?
Great.
And like it was like, yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. So that's what you were doing while you've already shot the pilot.
Shot the pilot. That's but amazing. I mean, like nobody knows if these things are going to go.
Yeah.
And we were talking
yeah.
about this, about that thing that everybody on every set of every pilot has all said. This is something that Tony Hale taught me early on. He's like, every single person is going to tell you this show's going to go. It's a sure thing. And he said, I've been on 5 pilots since Arrested Development, and 4 of them have not. Everybody said this, but 4 of them have not gone, and 1 got picked up, and it was for 4 episodes. Yeah. So I just went back to work. And
smart.
Until it got
yeah.
picked up to series, that's when I quit. Yeah.
And then I was also reading that the role of Jonah was originally written for someone who on paper does not look or sound like you, a very different character.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, when you were cast and you started filming, how much of your personality did you bring to this role and yourself? Because also, maybe not personality, Jonah's a horrible person, I take that back, but like how much could you kind of change the role when you also have a phenomenal writer is kind of creating it?
There are like very unfortunately parts of myself that I am basing this guy on, like especially in those early years, like now, like to the point that he's gotten now, that's sort of that snowballed into its own thing.
Yeah.
But like very early on, it was just like, oh, like, well, when I feel slighted, what do I feel mm-hmm. like when I feel slighted? And like, if I get ambitious, how does that look like? That sort of like, those are the things that I grabbed a hold of. Mm-hmm. But by the time we got in there, like so much of it was informed by that rehearsal process that we had in the pilot, that by that time, that thought of that this had been written for somebody very different than me had mm-hmm. kind of gone away
yeah.
just because we were all in there working together, and it wasn't like I was fighting against it.
Sure.
And Armando, one of the great things about Armando as a showrunner and our showrunner is that he is completely open to things mm-hmm. changing. Like I think initially scripted, the character Mike is much meaner and much harsher and in his sort of like I've been around forever thing, he was way meaner, but Matt Walsh brought something to it that wasn't that. And
it's a deep sadness.
It's like a yeah, like yeah, a very yeah. deep sadness.
Yeah.
And like this sort of like this guy who's just like trying to get up every day and do yeah. his best but just live through it. Like that's
yeah,
kind of what right. Matt brought
live
to
through it.
It.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that like so
that's
everybody
wonderful.
Adjusted a little bit.
Right.
He just cast the best person that came in for it. Even that was against what he initially thought.
Yeah.
He just did that.
And I read that like he doesn't quite care if you have great credits or other experience. I read that if you impress him in the room, like that's what matters more than anything. That's such a wonderful way to think about casting a show.
Yeah,
creating a show.
I mean, if it's not for Allison not
yeah.
caring that I didn't have any credits,
right.
and if it's not Armando who doesn't care, he's just like, oh, that read was funny.
Yeah,
and he seemed like an okay guy. Like, I might not have gotten it if this was somewhere else, if it wasn't HBO who allowed those guys the space to just make those decisions.
Right.
If somebody else was in their ear, like, we need somebody more experienced, this guy hasn't done anything. I don't know if I would have gotten it.
It's so wild to think of the show with different cast members, because it's such an amazing ensemble. I do want to ask, you know, we talked about the shooting the pilot. Just finally, I want to ask, like, it'll be so hard for me as a fan to say goodbye to this show. I'm kind of dreading it, even though I'm very excited to see how it ends. I'm kind of dreading it. What were, for the cast and crew, what were those last table reads like, last scenes to shoot? What were those last days on set like? I imagine it was very difficult.
It was, because we've all gotten pretty close, and they're, like, I had kids throughout the course of filming. Reed got married and had kids. Like, we all sort of grew up in this thing. There's even one baby that Sean and Callie met, who at the time was the office PA. Sean was the office PA, and Callie was Armando's assistant. They met on the first day of the pilot.
Amazing.
They started dating, they got married, and now they have a baby. And that baby would not exist if our show did not film in Baltimore. And like that sort of thing is such a part of this that like it does feel like we have turned into family, for better or worse. Like, we all had our days.
Yeah, of course.
Or for better or worse, like, we were family. And so that last table read was incredibly emotional, and everybody cried a whole lot, and Julia made a really lovely speech, and then we all just got to laugh for a solid hour when we did the table read. And it felt like the end of high school, when you still have like a lot of stuff to get done. It's spring in high school, you have a lot of stuff to get done, but you don't care, and everybody's in a good mood, and everybody's making jokes, and like the last day, everybody showed up for everybody else's last scene to clap them out and give them hugs. And
that's wonderful.
And then everybody just stuck around. So by the time we got to Julia's last scene, there were probably 150 people in Video Village, just all doing like callback bits from season two and making jokes. And it was amazing. It was really amazing. Yeah. And then we drank on set for a while, and then they finally kicked us out and we went back to the writer's room and we had drinks there trying to pretend that it wasn't over. And then the very last thing that happened was Lou Morton, who's one of our EPs and sort of Dave's right-hand man. Mm-hmm. They've worked together for a long time as a writer. He gave me a hug and was like, right. This was five people left who were all the ones that were like, really didn't want to let it go.
Yeah.
And it was clearly me, Walsh, who had a bunch of tequila, and Sam Richardson and Dave and Lou. Mm-hmm. And it was finally like, we just have to do
enough.
It. It's enough. The show ended. It's 3:30 in the morning. We have to go. And Lou gave me a hug and was like, hey, look at that. We all used to work on a show called Veep.
Wow.
And that was like the last moment.
Wow, what an amazing button.
Yeah, man. He's a good writer.
It's fitting that he ended even that on an amazing note.
Yeah.
Thank you again for your work as Jonah and the work on the show. I love this show so much, and I can't say enough good things about it. If you've managed to listen through this entire podcast about Veep and haven't watched it, go start Veep right now.
Yeah, it seems like, so would somebody stick all the way through this if they
had never
seen it? If you're
like the handful of listeners, yeah. Right. It's, I told you this earlier, it's one of the only shows that starts great and gets better. Like, that's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
The first season is great, and then from there it just gets funnier. And I don't know how.
That's all just because of our Arm and Dave. Arm and Dave somehow managed to pull that off. I know I had nothing to do with it.
You were all right. You did
I was
okay.
all right in it. I did fine. Well, that was those guys.
It's such a great show. Thank you again.
Thanks, man.
Good luck with what's next.
Cheers.
This is such a
pleasure.
We shook hands.
Like, if you're listening, you couldn't see
if you
that,
heard that
just
like just
hands.
Soft contact.
The soft clap of skin together. That was that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.